Shoes.
Recorded live.
This conference is being recorded. Muted.
As well, no, right here. I'm Dorothy Roberts.
Unmuted.
On the news tonight, the family of a man found hanging in a tree in the Mississippi Delta is calling for a federal investigation into his death. Relatives of 26-year-old Frederick Jermaine Carter and their attorney were joined by the Mississippi NAACP this morning in Jackson. Family members dispute claims by authorities that Carter committed suicide. That is, they say they have evidence he was murdered. Carter was found hanging in a tree December 3rd. In a field near Greenwood, the FBI assisted the LaFleur County Sheriff's Department with the investigation and found no evidence of murder.
Investigation. To ensure that there is a legitimate full investigation that's taking place at that time, we will provide whatever information that the Carter family and their attorney have gathered up to this point to ensure that individuals who are doing the investigation have all the documentation information needed to come to a clear conclusion.
Now, Sheriff Ricky Banks says Carter had attempted suicide before. The family acknowledges he did have a history of mental problems. There has been no official ruling in Carter's death.
Context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade Justice, in for another program to share constructive information on racism, white supremacy, what it is, and how it works. I want to thank everyone for tuning into the program. As always, I hope you get useful, constructive information. We have way too many problems to solve to be wasting time. We definitely want to be making sure we're using our time in the most efficient, effective manner possible. Again, I want to thank listeners for making suggestions. Our guest for this evening's program was a suggestion last year. Sometimes you have to have patience, too, just to hope that schedules can work out and all that good stuff. But I do listen when people make suggestions. You can email, put it on Facebook or what have you, and I will try my best to get folks on the program. But, yeah, I contacted our guest last year about being a guest, and I think she's published about two or three books since that time. We switched around the book that we were going to look at. She's written a ton on racism, white supremacy. Some of the books that she has authored, we have Racism in a Racial Democracy, The Maintenance of White Supremacy in Brazil. She also authored Outsourcing the Womb, Race, Class, and Gestational Surrogacy in a Global Market. The book we're going to talk about today, A White Side of Black Britain, Interracial Intimacy and Racial Literacy. Very interesting book. I read a small piece of it on the program, I believe, last week. The book came in the mail while we were on the air, and I believe I read a little bit from chapter two. Really striking passage, this book. She'll be able to tell you more about it, but this is directly from white parent, white woman. She has a black non-white child, and she's talking about some of the problems around this because of racism. And she says, is there not something unseemly in our society about the spectacle of a white woman mothering a black child? A white woman giving totally to a black child. A black child totally and demandingly dependent for everything. Sustenance itself from a white woman. Very interesting passage, really interesting book, and we're real pleased to have her on the program joining us live this evening, Professor France Windance Twine. Professor Twine, are you with us?
I am. I'm really, really honored to be a part of your program, and thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. We're grateful to have you on the broadcast. If you would like to share with our listeners anything you think would be helpful for them to know about you moving into the program, any constructive information you'd like to share, please feel free.
Okay. Right now, I grew up in Chicago in a working class community. I'm black. I grew up in a working class black community, and then at one point I lived in a predominantly Irish American community in Chicago before moving to New Orleans and in New York City. And I've lived in California for about 2 decades now. So, and my grandfather was a civil rights activist. His name is Paul Twine Sr. And he marched with Martin Luther King Jr. in 63 and was part of, he was a co-founder of the Interracial Catholic Council, which was a civil rights organization that brought Catholics of different racial and ethnic backgrounds together because, unfortunately, there was racism in the Catholic Church. You know, religious institutions weren't immune from racism. So, yes.
Wow. Do you want to tell them anything about your work at University of California, Santa Barbara?
So I earned my PhD from Berkeley in 1995, and I taught for three years at the University of Washington in Seattle. I was hired in 98 to teach in the sociology department in UC Santa Barbara. And I was hired to contribute to the program in race, ethnicity, and nation. I consider myself to be an anti-racist scholar, and what that means is that I'm interested in teaching and doing research in areas that can lead to a more racially just society and to educating my students on how we all participate in racism and anti-racism, how we engage in everyday practices that either challenge it, either challenge racial domination or basically leave it intact. So I feel very fortunate that I was hired in a department that has a commitment to racial justice and where I have other colleagues who are also engaged in work that has an anti-racist orientation. Unfortunately, I don't think that is as common as we would think in a lot of universities. I don't think racial justice is necessarily at the forefront of the research agendas of a lot of people. So I feel very grateful that I've received support for my work because my research has occurred primarily outside of the United States, which means I've had to travel, you know, to other countries to conduct my interviews and to do my field research, and that takes a lot of time. So I feel that the University of California has really accommodated me and supported me in that. During a time when affirmative action was dismantled and where, you know, there's ambivalence on the part of some people, not in my department, but I think in general, we see a retrenchment away from racial justice in many places.
Wow. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
Oh, no, that's what I wanted to say. So, yes, I've been at the University of California. I've also taught at Duke University. And unfortunately, I wish I could say that racism is less of a problem today than it was 20 years ago, but I can't say that. I think it remains a serious problem. And especially if we look at the incarceration rates of particularly black men and women and brown-skinned Latinos and Native Americans, these groups are overrepresented. And so I think that I sincerely hope that the books I write have some small impact and can help people understand how much work still needs to be done.
Okie dokie. I'm ready to hop into your book, but this program, The Cows, Context of White Supremacy. Begin every program, I share my definition for racism. I use the terms racism and white supremacy as synonyms. I use the same definition for both terms. The definition that I use is as follows. A global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you believe that such a system exists, and do you think that definition is accurate?
Well, I definitely think we have white supremacy, but I think it's a little more complicated because I think that there are people who may or may not be physically qualified for whiteness, but who benefit from, who are able to participate as honorary whites in that system. I think class is really important, class inequality, and I think that there are people who will be classified as white who are also subjugated by the elites in their country. And so do I think there's a system of white supremacy? Yes. I think it's complicated and that it assumes different forms in the post-civil rights and post-colonial era. And I think that one does not have to be white or classified as white to participate and support that system. So I think it's important to focus on people who are white but who are challenging that and who are anti-racist. And I think there are people who are not white who support white supremacy. So I think it's complicated, and I think it's important to look at the national context and the local context, because I think the boundaries between white and not white can be more fluid than we may be aware of or comfortable with. You know, I think there's a lot of fluidity at the borders of what is white, what is not white. And we've seen that historically in places like South Africa and the United States when people have gone to court to get reclassified by race. So, yes, there's definitely white supremacy. It has had a global reach. But I think in order to understand how it operates and to dismantle it, you have to pay very careful attention to the local and national context and to the historical moment. Did I respond?
Oh, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Wow. Okay.
So, and I think we have to all, and I think as America, I think Americans are not always very, what's the term I want? We're socialized to minimize class inequality and the significance of class inequality because we have this whole discourse of the American dream. And as you know, people can work very hard their entire lives and not achieve that dream. So I think we have to pay attention also to poverty and to class inequality and how that's linked or integrated with what you're calling white supremacy.
Oh, I want to try and cover as much material as possible. I'm going to try and be as efficient as I can with my questions, and hopefully we can get to as much material of yours as we can. My co-host, she has a couple questions as well about your views on racism and some of your writings. Justice, if you have some questions for Professor Twine, your line should be open. I'm hearing a train.
I know. There's a train going by. I'm so sorry. It's going to be gone by in a minute. Okay, so your co-host has a question. Okay.
Oh,
I can take it. Thank you.
Sorry
about that.
Okay.
I can hear you. Hello?
Actually, she is in kind of a noisy area, too. I don't know if she's having train problems as well, but I'm going to give her a little time so that some of the noise can kind of filter out of the background, and then she'll ask her question.
Okay.
So while we're waiting for her noise problems to dissipate, I'll get in one quick question. One of your more recent books, A White Side of Black Britain, Interracial Intimacy and Racial Literacy. It's kind of a two-parter. Who is the intended audience for this book, and what is your ultimate objective with this book?
Okay, well, first I'd like to say a little bit about the book. I don't know how much your audience knows about this book. This book was published in January of this past year. It's a book that I spent 12 years working on and researching. A White Side of Black Britain, the title refers to the fact that 50% of UK-born black men, I'm sorry, yeah, 50% of UK-born black men had a white partner. At the time I began research for this book, I looked at the census data for the UK, and it turned out that somewhere around 40% of children of African ancestry in the UK had a white parent, and that parent was more likely to be the mother. So I thought, wow, that is really significant. And that means that the Black British community is more similar to the Hispanic or Asian American community in the U.S. in terms of out-marriage rates, and in terms of the predominance of a lot of multiracial families. So I initially started this research because it was an extension of earlier research that I had done in Brazil. But I was interested in, given the percentage of multiracial families in urban centers in London, black-white families, I was interested in how they negotiated race and racism, particularly I became interested in white women who are English and Irish who are raising children who may or may not acquire a black identity, because I had done some research as a graduate student at Berkeley on identity formation among children of African descent in the U.S. in the post-civil rights moment. I had interviewed a number of young adults who were struggling with what it meant to have had one parent who was black and the other parent who wasn't. And I thought, well, it would be interesting to see how that's managed in a different national context. I wrote this book because I wanted to provide access to a debate or a discussion that I didn't feel was really being theorized or being addressed. And that is the main question I was interested in is, what distinguishes white people, those white people who form families with blacks and are raising children with them, what distinguishes those who develop an anti-racist identity and learn how to see everyday racism, a term I get from Philomena has said, what distinguishes them from those white people who develop relationships with blacks but don't become racially conscious, don't experience a transformation in their vision, and don't think racism is a problem? What's the difference? And I was interested in trying to kind of figure out under what conditions do white people become conscious of the devastating effects of everyday racism? Now, obviously, one does not establish a family with a black person or have children in order to acquire what I call racial literacy, which is a concept that I developed. But I was interested in learning about that because I thought if we can understand that, maybe we can take those lessons and help more and help educate younger white people to help them see how they can redefine what it means to be white, and that you don't have to be, you don't have to embrace racial domination or white supremacy in order to be proud of your of being white, and that basically we need white allies. I mean, the civil rights movement would not have been effective without white people bearing witness to white racism and putting their lives on the line. So I thought, what can we learn from the British experience? Since in Britain, or at least in the UK, the cities that I lived in, class segregation seemed more predominant to me than racial segregation, at least when you compare it to, when you compare England to the US or South Africa. In other words, in the UK, although blacks are not evenly distributed across every region, if you look in the South and the Midlands, blacks tend to be sorted more by class, and so they're less segregated from white people who are in their same class position. I grew up in Chicago where, regardless of your level of education or your class, if you were black, you tended to live in a predominantly black neighborhood. The degree of segregation in the U.S., at least for blacks, is very severe. And so what I saw in the U.K. was an opportunity to learn something from white people there who had established families with blacks, and to write about it and say, look, here's a country that has, you know, has race problems, has had a history of race riots, but they seem to actually have a higher level of integration, racial integration, at least on the surface, in some communities than we do. And can we learn something from that experience? Also, if we're going to really achieve racial justice, we need to understand what conditions motivate white people to become more sophisticated about how racism operates, and how do they teach their children and prepare them to deal with it. So I see the audiences, both undergraduates and graduates in sociology, but also just lay people, people who are interested in racial justice and who want to learn something from parents who are struggling with this every day. And,
racially?
Pardon me?
Like the racial makeup of your intended audience?
I guess I see it as multiracial, but I guess I feel that whites can learn a lot more from this than blacks. And I may be making assumptions, but I guess I see my audience as multiracial, but I'm hoping that the white reader who reads this will really have their eyes opened and have a transformative experience and learn something, and then they can take those lessons and teach other people in their community.
Curious. I was looking at some of the trends in some of your work. I was curious. Are both of your parents black?
My mother is black, and my father was part black, and both of my parents self-identified as black, yes.
Oh, okay. Did you have a white grandparent?
No.
Interesting. Very interesting.
I did have a stepfather who was white at one point in my life, but I grew up around, I mean, there were white people in my community, in my life. What made you ask that question?
It's an interesting trend in your work. It seems to center a lot around sexual intercourse between white people and non-white people. That seems to be a big part of the...
Really? Oh, okay. Well, I think what you're seeing is I realize that you cannot change anything in the U.S. Black people are a numerical minority in this country, and that means that we can't have the, we're not going to achieve racial justice without some white people deciding they're committed to that. I mean, if you think about it, if the white middle class population of this country, if half of them decided that racism was no longer acceptable, it would change pretty quickly. And so I think given the racial demographics of this country and given how power is allocated, we are not going to achieve our goals of racial justice without whites deciding that it's their problem and that they're committed to it. So what you see in my work is me trying to find a way to communicate with people who are not black but who may care about racial justice and may want to live in a country that fulfills the dream that, basically begins to recognize that we do have the power to change things in this country. We can have a more racially egalitarian society. Unfortunately, we cannot do it if it's just the black and Latino population or black, Latino, Asian. It has to involve people who self-identify as white. And one of the things I've learned in my reading and just my research and teaching over the last decades as a sociologist is that white students respond differently to material and stories that involve white people. Like if they read something and they can identify with the person and it's a white person talking about racism, there's a different response. Right? That's just, and so I also think that my white students will have a different response reading a book that's about white people who've made a decision to challenge racism in their everyday life.
That's interesting.
It gives them role models, right?
Wow. Okay. I'll share and see what your thoughts are on this. This is very interesting, and it's something I'm noticing as I listen to you explain more about your research and your book and your views on racism. This is very different for me because I have unfortunately concluded that white people are not going to stop practicing racism worldwide. White people the evidence just doesn't show that white people are going to stop doing this. And we've had a lot of white people on this program. I've never had a white person come on this program and say anything different. Tim Wise, and he admitted racist, Timothy Wise has been on, and he said there just isn't any evidence that would suggest that white people are going to voluntarily stop practicing racism. And in fact, we had Dr. Barbara Trepanier. She's the author of Silent Racism, Admitted Racist. She was on the program a week ago, and she said that one of the fundamental problems as to why we have not ended the system of white supremacy is that there are people who believe there are some white people that are good, there are some white people that are not racist. And this is a white woman. She's saying that just is not true. I don't know. It seems like you think that, there's a hope that white people can be changed so that they don't do this.
Well, first of all, I'm not arguing that white people aren't racist. What I'm arguing is that children are not born racist, okay? And if you can, I don't want to sound like I'm living in a fairy tale world because I'm not. I mean, I grew up in Chicago. There's no way you can grow up in Chicago, and I've witnessed overt racism at a young age and live in a fairy tale. But what I will say is that I do have hope that we can live in a world that's more just than the one we're in now. And I believe that it's not possible if you just give up and say, okay, white people are not capable of giving up power. I don't know that I'm going to live to see a radical change, but I didn't think I'd see a black president either. Now, I don't want to get into the discussion about Obama and his blackness and how black he is, but I never thought I would see that. what I think is that young people today are growing up in a world that's different from the world my parents grew up in. Now, there is still structural racism in the society in the U.S., and it's still pretty bad. But I do think that my students lack a vocabulary for talking about racism, for understanding how it operates, and that maybe this is a very, very small goal that I have, and maybe it won't fundamentally make a big difference. But one of my hopes and desires and goals in writing this book was to show my white students, look, this is how racism operates every day. Here are some of the mundane, invisible ways it operates. And this is how a white person in a multiracial family sees it operating, and this is how they respond. And I do think that there are young people who aren't even aware, like they don't even think racism is a problem today, right? And so I think that for me, if I can just help some of my students who are white understand, yes, it's a problem today. Here are some of the ways it manifests in families, and here are some of the ways that white parents have responded to it. It begins, it's the beginning of a conversation. And does that mean they're going to become anti-racist? I can't say that. I can say that I have had students who are white who have become anti-racist through their learning and their reading and just being taught how to even conceptualize what race or racism is. So I guess I need to maintain that hope that if we could even change, if we could even get 10% of the white population to admit that racism is a serious problem and to care about it, I think that could have a radical impact. I mean, if you look at the civil rights movement, the majority of people in this country were not involved in it. The majority, I mean, I've gone back and listened to news broadcasts where you had respected white commentators saying the Negroes are asking for too much, they're demanding too much, right? But change occurred, and it wasn't enough, but one of the reasons some change occurred is white people got educated. Hmm. Some of the young white people who went down to the South on the freedom. Huh?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but my co-host, she's back now, and I think the noise has subsided.
Okay, I just want to finish this one point,
okay,
which is a lot of young white people who went down in the early 60s on the Freedom Rides, they learned something. They got educated. Now, does that mean the whole world changed or they gave up white privilege? No, but they strategically deployed their white privilege in support of civil rights. And it was a small group of people, but it still made a difference.
Context of white supremacy, our guest, Professor France Windance Twine. Okie doke, I think she has a quieter background now. Justice, if you have some questions for Professor Twine, your line should be open. Please go right ahead. Oh, whoops. Online. Okay. Your line should be open. I think we can hear you now.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Greetings to the guests and to everybody else that is on the line and, of course, Gus. I am in the car and my ears are a little bit plugged, but my question is, how do you think your book, A White Side of Black Britain, Interracial Intimacy and racial your book is constructed and working against the system of racism and white supremacy.
You know, I couldn't hear the last part of your question. Could you repeat that for me?
Okay, so my question is, how do you think your book is constructive in working against the system of racism and white supremacy.
Okay. Honestly, I'm not sure. I can tell you what my intention is. My intent is to help people understand, to help. It's my hope, okay? It is my hope that if a white person reads this book, that they will recognize part of themselves in it, and that they will realize or become more conscious of their own assumptions and how they may or may not be participating in racism through their everyday practices. And it is my hope that some of the people who read the book will become more aware, and that some of those people are teachers and will realize, because one of the things I do in the book is I present this concept of racial literacy, and there are two chapters devoted to that. So my hope is that people will read the book and that some of the people who read it will be teachers, and they will take this book and have a dialogue and get and teach their students about everyday racism and make it more visible, because I think one of the problems is that a lot of people don't believe that racism is a serious problem. They blame black people, they blame Latinos, they blame poor people of color for problems that are a consequence of structural racism. So it's my hope that this book will provide a language and a set of concepts that can be useful for people who are teaching. And I don't necessarily mean in an academic setting either. It could be in a church setting. It could be in a number of settings. But that they can teach them, look, everyday racism is a problem, and here are some of the ways it's manifest, and this is what it looks like. But, of course, I can't guarantee that, but that's my hope.
Do you have a white parent?
No, I do not have a white parent. And I think it's really interesting that a lot of people make that assumption. I do not have a white parent. My mother was a dark-skinned black woman whose family was from Louisiana. And I guess I wonder what motivates that question of why would you think that I have a white parent? This book is not about me or my life. It's not about that. It's about my interest and my commitments as an anti-racist scholar. Did you assume I have a white parent because I wrote this book?
I wasn't assuming anything. I was just curious. I was just wondering.
Why is that an important question? I'm not sure why that question's relevant.
I didn't say it was important. I didn't assume anything. I was just curious because you wrote a book about it and you talk about it. And your work is about that.
No, my parents. Right. No, my parent, I don't have a white parent, no. I do not.
Okay, that's all I'm asking.
Okay.
How do you work to produce justice?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that question?
How do you work to produce justice?
You know, one of the ways that I try to do that work is through the courses I teach, through the readings that I assign, because I am a teacher, right? I'm an educator. That's one of the areas that I work in. But I guess I really try to teach and give my students access to information that I think they haven't had before, and I try to teach them the history of race and racism. I try to provide them with a set of conceptual tools that will help them to understand how racism has affected their lives, regardless of their particular racial or ethnic background. You know, I work in a university context in which the majority of my students are white and or Mexican American. I don't actually have that many black students. The only time I really had black students in a significant numbers is when I taught at Duke University. So I am teaching in a very particular context. I think if I were teaching like at a historically black college, my answer might be different, right? But because I'm teaching in what I would call a historically white university, and that's probably most universities in the U.S., one of the things I try to do is just help my students see a different perspective. And so I assign authors they wouldn't typically read who are black and or Latino or Native American. And so some of it, I think, is just trying to help my students become more educated and learn more about the history of racism, which they haven't learned about. I have a lot of students who are juniors or seniors in college, and they really haven't learned U.S. history in a way that's accurate or honest.
What do you do when you are around white people who practice racism, white supremacy?
You know, that's a very tough question because racism, as you know, comes in a lot of different forms. And so it really depends on the situation. I mean, I have been in situations of overt racism, and when that occurs, I challenge it. But often, a lot of times, the racism that I encounter is very subtle, and it's in forms that are difficult to challenge. So it really depends on the particular situation. If I have an opportunity to challenge it directly, I do that. I've been in situations where I've written letters, where I've stopped patronizing certain businesses. It really depends. I've lived in 4 different regions of the United States, so my response to that has really varied depending on the context I was in and whether I felt physically safe. That's another issue. You know, at whether I'm alone. So my response has varied depending on whether I'm alone or whether I'm in a situation where I feel safe or whether I have black relatives present. So it's difficult. But I would say I always challenge it, but the way you challenge it really depends on the particular form that the racism is taking.
Do you speak to non-white children about racism, white supremacy? If so...
Do I speak to whom?
Do you speak to non-white children about racism, white supremacy that have a white parent? If so, what do you tell them specifically about it?
Well, first of all, I don't use the term non-white. Do I speak to people who are from... First of all, I don't speak to children. I teach... At the university level, most of the students that I'm involved with are roughly 18 to 23. I don't generally go around giving lectures on racism to children from multiracial families, if that's what you're asking. I teach general courses in sociology. Most of my courses are on gender inequality, and I do teach courses on race at the graduate level.
Interrupting, but just to clear up some more confusion, what do you mean when you say interracial interracial?
Well, if you read my book, you would see that I defined it, and I don't typically use the term interracial. I actually, in my book, use the term transracial. It's on my book cover because that's a term that Americans recognize. For me, the term interracial, which I rarely use, refers to, so when I use the term interracial intimacy on the book, it refers to two people who are socially classified as belonging to groups that are believed to be racially distinct. Now, we know that race is a social political construction, and that it's something that was invented during a particular moment. But I use that term to refer to two people who are presumed to belong to different, what are viewed as different racial groups. That's how I use the term. But I was actually trying to answer a question you posed earlier. I teach courses at the university level, both graduate and undergraduate. I don't typically talk to children about, unless they're children in my immediate, in my own family. I don't tend to go lecture children. Most of my my lectures, if I talk about racism, is with adults who are enrolled in courses.
If a non-white child has a white parent and that white parent is practicing racism against the child, what should the child do?
You know, that's a situation where I think other adults, I'm not a social worker, but that's a situation where I would hope there were other adults in the family, and if they witnessed that they would intervene. And in terms of the child, I think it really depends on the age of the child, right? If we were talking about a child who's a teenager, obviously they have more ability to respond, right, or to fight back. I think it's very difficult for young children to respond to that. I have never witnessed that. I've never witnessed directly what you are describing. And I'm, you know, not a social worker, but I would hope that in families where that was occurring, that one, and that if an adult was present, that they would intervene in that. But my book is not actually about that, and that's not something, fortunately, that I have witnessed.
Okay. Thank you. Back to you, guys.
Of white supremacy. Again, our guest, France Windance Twine. Something I found it very interesting. As I said earlier, you know, I've concluded, white people are not going to stop practicing racism, which is, it's tough, but you know, I feel like it's not saying that I'm giving up. I definitely think this problem can be solved. I wouldn't be doing the program if I didn't think we could solve this problem. But unfortunately, I think the problem will have to be solved without very much, if any, assistance from white people. In fact, I expect maximum resistance from white people. And I see that even in your book. I feel like in reading your book, I see a lot of evidence that, you know, white people are just not going to stop practicing racism. In fact, some of, and I can't even say some, many of the statements from the white women themselves, I'll share a few of them. I'll share a few and then we'll get your thoughts. This is on page 75.
You might want to tell the audience which chapter you're in, just so they have a sense of what that chapter is about.
Okay. On page 75, this is chapter 2, Disciplining Racial Dissidents. This is chapter 2. And again, this book, she has these families that she's been following. She said she did 12 years of research. So she's been following white, mostly white women, but there are some white men as well, but mostly white women who are married to and have children with a black male living in Britain. And so some of these, I think all the quotes I'm going to read is going to be white women speaking. No white men made the quotes, I don't think. This first quote is from a white woman. Her name is Valerie, chapter 2. And she's talking about her non-white children. I don't want them to feel that because I'm white, racist thoughts are going through my mind, and I'm their mother. I get upset sometimes because I feel like, yeah, I'm white. I'm not happy with the way things have served them. Like from my family, which to me suggests her family is, you know, being racist to these children.
Right.
And I'm not very happy about the things I can't change. But I wouldn't like them to see me in the same way as they view my parents, as racist. I wouldn't like them to see all white people in the same sort of way as my family's been with them. this next quote, this is on page 98.
Well, can I just say something before you move on?
Yes,
so that quote, that is an example. That quote is in there because I want it. This particular chapter that you're quoting from is a chapter that's just kind of showing how white women from very different class backgrounds, the forms of racism they have to deal with coming from their own family. And that is representative. And her, and this woman is one of the women who is an anti-racist. And basically what she had to do was she started to restrict her children's, she started to basically regulate her children's relationship with their grandparents and minimize their time with them, with the white grandparents, and they started to spend more time with their black side of their family. But that quote is in there to show that this is a woman who, because of these experiences, she started to really have her children spend more time with the black side of their family. And it's very painful, and it gives you an example of kind of what some of these women have to give up, which is basically, in some cases, they give up contact with their white family members, their natal family. And it's really sad, and that's one reality.
On page 98, this is, again, a white woman. She's talking about her experience being married to a black male. Her name is Alessandra. She says,
mm-hmm.
This is page 98 from chapter 3, The Concept of Racial Literacy.
Mm-hmm.
And Alessandra, she says, I would probably have had an abortion if the circumstances were different. But I daren't tell my mom because of what's going on at home with my brother. The district nurses were coming around and giving him shots of morphine. I think if my dad had had his way, I would have been gone because my dad is very racist and still is to this day. I love my dad, and my daughter, who's non-white, loves her grandfather, but his racism is something that we haven't hid from her. And she goes on to say that her grandfather, he does change, and he develops a close relationship with his granddaughter. However, he is still racist. This is from chapter 3. I was going to go and I was going to try and get in a few more of these direct quotes. Can I go to the next quote, or did you want to get anything in?
Well, did you want me to answer any questions or provide context? Yeah, there are a lot of quotes like that. And I think this quote is an example of a white woman from a working class background who went back to school in her 30s. And got her BA in sociology and has acquired what I call racial literacy. And it's also an example of a woman who, despite her father's racism, the grandfather of her daughter went on to marry a black man who's actually a very famous footballer, athlete. He's a very well-known athlete in the UK. Her daughter married a black man and has had two sons who are black. And what is interesting about this situation is that, yeah, the grandfather is still racist, although it sounds like he has a good relationship with his granddaughter. And this is exactly the kind of thing, the kind of material that I want white students to read and understand, that this is today. This is still relevant. And because a lot of my students, they are from monoracial families. So they don't really, they're from families that didn't talk about race or racism, didn't discuss it, didn't deal with it. So they can kind of pretend these things aren't relevant. And so it's actually very painful for me to hear this because I know the people in this book. But I think it's important for young people to know, yes, this sort of thing is still happening, especially since the U.S. is so segregated racially and by class. It's very easy for a huge segment of the population to be completely oblivious to the pain that racism causes.
If it's acceptable, I want to get in. I have five more that I just really want to share with listeners. I'll read these quickly, and then you can kind of give thoughts on all five of them together, if that's all right.
I'll try. We'll see. I don't know which five you're referring to. It's your show, so go ahead and read whichever quotes you'd like.
Okay.
Are they from different chapters?
I'll give out. Yes, they are from different chapters, but I'll give out
okay.
all the information. This one is page 106. This is also chapter 3, so same chapter on racial literacy. This is Chelsea, still white women. I think it's all white women. This is Chelsea. And she says, this is a white woman. I'm very suspicious of white people. I notice how easy it is for me to be a part of that white community.
She doesn't say white community. She says of that community.
Right. I want to make sure. I mean, she's talking about the white community, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Right. But you're quoting her, and she says that community.
Okay. And yet, I feel like I'm not a part of it. She's talking about the white community and can't be a part of it because it's always going to, in some sense, reject my daughter, who is not white. It's a culture that doesn't readily accept black people. So I feel that if I have a friendship or a relationship with white people, I always think that there's a barrier that's always there with white people. Again, now this is a white person speaking.
Right. No, and this is what you haven't read, which is on page 92, is my definition of racial literacy. And this is a very good quote because this is I have that quote in there because it's an example of her. She's racially literate, so she sees how racism operates. And I'm using her as an example of what Du Bois, W.E.B. Du Bois, would call somebody who has double consciousness. Because she's white, and she sees her privileges as a white person, but she also can see the world from her daughter's perspective as someone who's not white. So she's always moving between, I'm white, and when I'm on my own, and people don't see my white daughter, my black daughter, she considers her daughter black, this is how I'm treated. But when I'm with my daughter, so she's an example of someone who can basically see the world from the perspective of her daughter and is very concerned about the damage that white people can cause her daughter.
And rightly so.
Rightly so.
Very
justified. And, you know, I am not trying to present a fairy tale here. As you know, from that same page, I say that only 1/4 of the women I interviewed possessed what I call racial literacy. 3/4 did not. 3/4 of the people in the study did not. But she's an example of someone who did possess it.
Okay. I want to, again, if it's acceptable, I have 4 more. If I can get through these last 4, then I'll hush and you can give your commentary if that's acceptable. I'm switching chapters, not on chapter 3 anymore. I'm switching to chapter 8. I'm on page 238. Chapter 8, 238, and the title of this chapter is Gender Gaps in
Can you just tell people roughly what this chapter is about, just so you set it up for them to quote?
Let's see. This is Kevin and Dorothy. We have a black female with a white man. This is a white person, I guess, who Kevin, who is becoming more aware of racism because he's in a relationship with a black female. I guess in general this chapter is a little different. Most of the book focuses on white women with black males. This chapter switches it, and we have some white men who are with black females. It looks at some of the differences because most studies that look at what are called interracial relationships don't focus on white men with black females, some of the different treatment that they get, and this is one of the anecdotes. Kevin and Dorothy. Kevin, white man. Dorothy, black female. And this is page 238, chapter 8. Now, having spent time with my wife, who's a black female, I realize that I am a bit racist in terms of preconceptions and ideas that you have about black people. There were jokes about the length of a black man's penis. My attitude then was, well, I'd quite like somebody to make a joke about how big mine was. And my wife sort of explained to me, and once it had been explained to me, I thought, you're right. I used to tell jokes like that, but I've avoided those now. As soon as somebody starts to tell a joke that's got any mention of the race or whatever of the person, I tend to frown. And then afterwards, I dissect the joke. Very interesting commentary. He also goes on to talk about some of the other jokes that he's heard some of his white friends tell. And he does say that he doesn't hang around with these white people anymore who are telling, you know, these sorts of racist jokes. That's been.
He's changed his entire network. He's pretty much changed his network. He's left the, you know. That's an example of someone who was educated, became educated about racism from his black partner. Yeah.
Okay. This is 242, same chapter, Gender Gaps in Interracial Intimacy. this is same couple, Kevin and Dorothy. And this is Dorothy speaking. From the moment we got serious, she's talking about her and her partner, Kevin, white man. From the moment we got serious, then I always knew that we would marry because I wanted the black community to see that I was not being abused by him. Because a lot of the black community would look at it and think, oh, there's another white man with a black woman just taking advantage of her. And I wanted the white community to see that it was legitimate. I wanted them to see that it wasn't, you know, this master-slave relationships thing again. But it was a matter of choice. So it was important that we marry. This is chapter 8, black female speaking this time. Flipping back, I'm going to page 91. So we're going back.
Wait, hold. What made you choose that quote to read?
I thought it was very revealing that the black female thought that white people would look at her relationship, a significant number of white people apparently, and think this is some sort of master-slave thing. The fact that she thinks white people are going to look at this in that manner tells me a lot about the power dynamics, and it seemed that other people had that same concern, that this is some sort of incorrect, you know, slave thing happening because of racism, white supremacy. I thought it was very, and particularly that a black female thought that white people would look at her relationship in that manner. I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah.
This is page 91. Page 91. I'm flipping chapters here. Now I'm on chapter 93. Chapter 93. We're back to chapter on racial literacy. This is, make sure I'm getting the female's name correct. These are not people in her study. She's just using a quote to bring in how white people can become racially literate. This is a different white scholar. She's sharing some of her material. Her name is Mab Segrest.
She's actually an anti-racist activist. She's a white activist to work with black people.
Okay, and this is, you're quoting from her memoir, in Memoir of a Race Traitor, it's 1994,
right.
And she writes, I was in daily intimate exposure to the cruel, killing effects of racism, which my black friends spoke of in the same way as they commented on the weather. I often found myself hating all white people, including myself. This is a white person talking. As I took on racism, I also found its effects could be turned on me. The possibility of overt violence or the reality of subtle ostracism gave me a sense of shared risk, not the same as the dangers faced by my friends of color, but close enough. And the thing that I took from that passage more than anything, we have a white person saying that they found themselves hating all white people, including themselves, just as they came to, you know, allege that they got a better understanding of racism. Again, speaking to exactly what I said at the very beginning, a big part of this problem, thinking that there are some good white people, thinking that white people are not all racist. And this, the final one I'll read, final quote, this is on page.
Hold on 1 second. What did you think of this particular person who's writing? She's an anti-racist activist who's put herself into danger. What did you think about her? Because she is an example of a white person who actually put herself on the line with her black colleagues in the South.
I think that that is a white person. I would love to get her on the program, number one, if it's possible. But I would tell her, and I would say this to her, I would just ask, are you a racist? And if she said yes, that would be the only way she would be referenced by me ever. She can allege to be an anti-racist and say that I've done all this work and I have battle scars and I've been to jail 50 times and I married a black person. All of that is irrelevant. If you are a white person and we're still in a system of white supremacy, I have that same suspicion that the white person in your book talked about. When I see a white person, I could care less what they are doing. That suspicion is there, and it's justified. I think that is a major part of what I think needs to happen, a fundamental change in the way that we see white people. And I guess I'll read this last quote to kind of punctuate my conclusion. And this is, again, these are white people talking. Well, actually, this is not a white person. The person I'm ending with is not a white person. This is a non-white female who has a white parent, one of the children in this study, who actually steps in and I think makes a brilliant analysis, which whole point of everything. Her name, I believe, is Jessica. She has a sister, Natasha, Jessica, and Natasha. Mm-hmm. I'll start on 124 and conclude it on 125. This is also This is chapter 4. Chapter 4, the title of the chapter is Racial Literacy in Practice. Okay, pay close attention. Words, white people and their refined use of words. It is important to note that Sonia, this is a white woman, Sonia has 4 children. And
what page are you on? I'm so sorry. You're on
124.
Oh, 24. I found it. Okay. Thank you.
It is important to note that Sonia, white woman, has 4 children, and not all of them share Natasha's analysis or had her experiences. I met 3 of Sonia's children at several family gatherings. I learned that 2 of her children held contradictory views of Sonia's racial literacy. Several months prior to my conversation with Natasha, Sonia introduced me to Jessica, her eldest daughter, and explained my research interests to her. Jessica said, "I hope that you told her the truth." After an awkward silence, Sonia replied that she had described her experiences accurately. Later, in a private conversation, Jessica told me that her mother doesn't really understand racism, but had merely learned the right words and discourses to use when she was a mature student at the local university. And I mean, brilliant analysis from the daughter in this situation,
right.
I think. I
included that, though, because I wanted to explain how she could have children who had different experiences. right? Because her youngest daughter believed that she was racially literate, and I think it's because her youngest daughter had a different experience than the older daughters.
Mm-hmm. To meet the point of that, the same suspicion that I would have of any white person. White people are very good at refining the way, being very subtle. You said yourself about being able to practice racism, white supremacy, and be undetectable in their ability to do so. And just for a daughter in this situation, she's not talking to a stranger. She's not talking to Tim Wise. She's talking to her mom and saying, I hope you didn't lie to this woman. You are not informed about racism. You're just very good at being able to talk about it and trick people. And I think, I mean, the whole evidence of white people is that. And, I mean, I guess my final point, what I said, your evidence, I would use your book to echo what I'm saying, that every single white person is a racist and that there really is not much evidence to say that white people are going to change. For all of the focus in your book, you said yourself, most white people did not develop any racial literacy. You said yourself, I think it was 80% of the non-white people that you spoke with, 80% of them did not do any anti-racist work. 75% of the white mothers in your study did not articulate an understanding of racism. It just, I mean, even your study, most of these white people in these relationships did not come out like Mab Segrest or Timothy Wise. Most of these white
right.
people, you
this
said yourself, they aren't even able to talk about racism as though they understand it.
This is true, and most black people are not out there working with the NAACP on the picket lines. I mean, you're absolutely right, the majority, but I guess you could accuse me of being naive. I guess I don't feel we need the majority. I guess I'm somebody who believes that 5 to 10% of the population could change everything. I mean, the civil rights activists did not represent the majority of the black community. You know, it was a small group of people who were really active, right? And so I cannot disagree with you that people, historically, people who have power don't just give it up. I mean, we know that. I guess I just have to hope, and maybe I'm telling myself a little story to make myself feel better, but I guess I hope that if we could even get a small minority of people to become like Mab Segrest, that could make a difference. And I may be wrong on that. And you're right. In this book, as you picked out some great quotes, and the reason those quotes are in there is because I'm not trying to whitewash this, right? I'm not trying to present sanitized account, right? But I guess I'm just trying to say, look, even in this context where the majority did not acquire racial literacy, some people did. And what can we do with those people? How can we find a way to empower those people who did acquire racial literacy, who were anti-racist? Is there a way that we can expand that group? And it sounds like you don't think we can.
I mean, I'm with Jessica. That group could be fooling us. That group could just be real skilled with their group, with their use of words. I mean, the history is that white. You say yourself in the book, when you go and speak to these people, some of them are refining their use of terms because you come back and they switch terms. Half-caste is no longer in vogue. Now it's dual heritage. You say that yourself. So some of this could just
right.
be these people get more refined in their ability to very subtly practice white supremacy, mask white supremacy. I'll make sure I don't tell any penis jokes about black people, and I won't be around too many white people who do that. But, I mean, I'll just go back to this quote. This is on chapter 2. And, again, for the record, most of these white people didn't even do that. Most of these white people didn't even become skilled at the use of words and talking about racism, or I would assert even helping their offspring who are being mistreated. This is page 2. When you have a quote where you have a white woman where she's saying to have a non-white child, she's white, she has a non-white child, to have a black child totally and demandingly dependent for everything, sustenance itself
oh,
from a
where
white.
Oh,
This is on page 60, the second.
Oh, right. Okay. Okay.
You see where I'm at? Page 60?
Right. Are you talking about the second quote?
Yes,
there
ma'am.
Not something unseemly? That's actually written by a black law professor. Patricia Williams is black.
Okay.
And she's a law professor at Columbia. But when she wrote this, I think she may have been. But that's a black law professor.
Okay. With the statement that she has here about a black child being totally and demandingly.
Yeah, that's a black. Mm-hmm.
Right, but I'm saying that statement, what she's sharing, even though the author is a black female, that statement, that seems like if you have a white person in a position, a white woman in a position where a black child is totally and demandingly dependent for everything, sustenance itself from a white woman, I mean, wow, if that white woman is a racist, that could be her dream come true, if that white woman is a racist. And I don't feel like that. I don't feel like that comes across. I feel like there's so much focus on this tiny minority of white people who allegedly are becoming racially literate and anti-racist because they have had sex with a non-white person or got married to a non-white person. It just doesn't seem representative of the sickness of racism, white supremacy. It seems as though it's giving too hopeful of an impression. It seems like it's not really giving an accurate representation of white people's dedication to this system. Like the white people in this book, it seems, are giving a more accurate depiction, saying that even the white people saying I have to develop a hatred of all white people when I get this understanding. I'm suspicious of all white people. I'm scared they're going to harm my child because I know even my father, people that are in my family, this is a direct relative and they're racist. He alleges to now have a good relationship with his granddaughter, but he's still a racist. That right there seems impossible. How can a racist have a good relationship with a non-white person? That seems totally against logic.
Let me just clarify. What you're saying is that your interpretation is that the focus on the fact that I focus on this group of women who I'm calling racially literate, you feel that's a misrepresentation or doesn't represent white's commitment to racism or to white supremacy. Is that what you're saying, Gus?
Yes, I think.
I think that's true. Okay,
okay.
So I think you're right. You're right. I am not, my goal, I feel that there is a really big body of literature on white racism and white supremacy. And my goal wasn't to contribute to that literature that exposes it, because I think it's pretty obvious that white supremacy as a system is pretty powerful and still very vibrant. And still in place. What I was trying to do, so you're right that I'm not doing justice to that. What I was trying to do was show a group of women, and it sounds like you're skeptical about whether they are racially literate. I was trying to focus on a group that has been invisible in discussions of racism and anti-racism, because there are people who, I mean, I met a lot of black British people, men primarily, who would have white mothers, and these are like prominent anti-racist activists and scholars in England. These are black. These are men who self-identify as black. And so one of the things that I found interesting, Gus, is that I met a lot of black people who were radicals, who were activists. And they didn't talk about the fact that they had white mothers, and that almost seemed taboo, right? So I became very interested in those women and men because I thought, well, did they have a role in their sons and daughters becoming racially conscious? And obviously I cannot generalize from this group that I present in the book. I'm not trying to make generalizations. I'm just saying, is there something we can learn from them? And it is true, you know, all the quotes that you identified, I mean, they're powerful because these are white English people, English and Irish, acknowledging the racism that they've witnessed and that they see. And you know what? If a white reader reads that, they may take that more seriously than if a black person said, oh, there's a lot of racism and it's very intense. So I am not trying to provide an accurate representation of the white commitment to racism because I think we already have that. I think a lot of people have done a very good job of documenting that and still are. I was trying to show how a few women arrive at it, kind of have more consciousness. Now, I can't force you to believe. Like, it sounds like I haven't convinced you that some of these women really are anti-racist or racially literate. It sounds like you're still skeptical about that.
Some
and
of these
I
women can't
really...
even convince their own daughters.
Right, yeah, and I'm not, obviously I included that in the book, right? So I wasn't trying to cover that up. But I do believe that there are women in this book who are anti-racist. I think the example you chose was not an example. I did not use that woman as like the best example. But I think that there's still something we can learn about the racial climate from this book.
I agree.
I think it does. So I would not disagree with what you said about white supremacy and its the fact that it is a very powerful global institution and that the average person is white person is not invested in dismantling that. I would not disagree with that. However, I would like to believe that there are white people who are open to becoming educated about white racism or white supremacy, and that maybe a very small percentage of those people could be allies in the anti-racist struggle. It sounds like you're skeptical about that, even.
I mean, all I can say is that white people, in fact, I don't think I've asked a single white person who has given me, you know, a different response. They have all said unanimously, there is simply no evidence that white people are going to voluntarily discontinue the practice of white supremacy.
They were talking about the U.S., right?
They were talking about the world. I mean,
we're
committed to studying white supremacy worldwide. I've had white people who are married to black people on my program admit, yes, I'm a racist, I'm a white supremacist, had their black wife giggling next to them as they said it, who was totally confused and clueless about what that meant.
Really?
And I mean, these people know. Anyway, if you have a question you'd like to ask, press *8 and we'll get your line. I am reminded of the quote of Dr. Bobby E. Wright. If you're at TalkShoe, press *8 and we'll see if we can get some questions in before our time runs out with Professor France Windance Twine. Dr. Bobby E. Wright's quote, "The greatest pathology in the world is to believe in something just because one wishes it to be so."
That's a great quote. That is a great quote.
The legend, Dr. Bobby E. Wright. Make sure you read that book, Psychopathic Racial Personality and Other Essays. I think he would be in the same camp with me. Do not, you know, put too much hope in these white people, you know, quitting anytime soon. that's a tough one. That is a very long shot. They should even replace it. It shouldn't be a dark horse. It should be a white horse waiting on them to stop practicing racism. Justice, did you have any other questions? I'm waiting for people on the phones. If you're on TalkShoe, *8 if you have a question. Justice, did you have any other question? Okay. I'll double-check to make sure her line is open. Justice, if you're there and you have any other questions for Professor Twine, your line should be – yeah, your line is open. Okay, I'll wait for her. Folks at TalkShoe, if you have a question, again, it's *8, *8, and I can get your question in for Professor Twine. Looks like some people are waiting to see if I can get hands. The book, again, that we're talking about. Oh, there we is. Go ahead, Justin.
Okay. Yeah, sorry. I was in a busy place. Okay. My next question is, if a non-white child... my next question is, okay, if you have offspring, how do you help your offspring learn and understand racism, white supremacy?
I only got part of the question. Can you repeat that? I'm sorry. I didn't hear the whole question.
If you have offspring, if you don't have any offspring, you can answer for younger children. How do you help your offspring or any younger children learn and understand racism, white supremacy?
The children in my family, basically, we try to educate them through the books that they read, through the classes, through the experience we give them, through places we take them. I mean, it's an ongoing, everyday practice. It's not, there isn't like a one simple formula. I think part of it involves just constantly talking to children, making sure they communicate with you about the experiences they have, and being very, very careful about what you expose them to, what they read, what they watch, watching films with them, explaining things to them. It's an ongoing, everyday, unending process. There isn't a simple formula. And as I said earlier, there are big differences between regions in the United States. So living in the West Village of New York and Manhattan is a different environment than Chicago, than Seattle, than other places I've lived in New Orleans. So I think you have to be attentive to the particular environment you're in and the class dynamics also. Because I think people who are privileged, I think that one of the things that I've noticed is that when you're in upper middle class or middle class milieus, the way racism gets expressed differs from working class environments. And that's another thing that you have to help children understand, that racism mutates and it takes different forms. And yeah, so there isn't one little simple solution. It depends on the age of the child. And I think you have to be careful about their friendship networks. You have to really monitor that.
What media would you recommend for children to learn and understand racism, white supremacy?
I don't privilege one particular medium. I guess it, as I said, it depends on their age. But I think at an early age, one of the things in my family that we did is we were very, very conscious about the types of children's books and songs and fairy tales that were allowed. We didn't do Disney. We were very conscious of the racism in a lot of mainstream Disney movies like Cinderella, Snow White, etc. So I think you can use any medium to educate a person, a child or an adult, about racism. There isn't one medium. It depends on the resources you have available to you and where you live.
Okay. So you can't, if you say there's like any media that can.
Well, I said all medium. There's various medium. You know, you can use comic books. You can use progressive comic books. There isn't one medium that I would say you can use. It depends on the age of the person you're talking about. We've used all sorts of medium, books, films, documentaries. I mean, Black History Month is very, very important to me. And that is a month, even though it's the shortest month of the year. In England, Black History Month is in October. But here, I mean, we use that month to really show a lot of documentaries, we read a lot of things. It's a group But I think that it's not about one medium. It's about just being consistent and consistently, whatever situation you're in, using that situation as an educational moment.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead, Jess. Well, thank you, and I don't have any more questions for you at this time.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Professor Twine, we had two callers. Do you have time for two final quick questions?
Sure, I can do two questions. Can you hold 1 second?
Yes, ma'am. The train. John Henryism. Every time I hear that, it reminds me of John Henryism.
Okay, yes, I can take two questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
No, but thank you. Thank you. V.A. Black, I guess, is the handle. The person who called in, V.A. Black. Did you have a question for Professor Twine?
I'm not sure if that's me. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Okay. I missed the first 20 minutes, so pardon me if this was asked already. I want to know if we all agree that there's a system of white supremacy in existence, what reason would white people have to fight against this system? I'll mute my line. Wait for the answer.
So, is that the end of the question, sir? Hello?
Yes, pardon me. That's the end. That's all I wanted to know. What reason they have to fight against it?
To fight against it? Okay. You know, not all white people benefit to the same degree from the system of white supremacy. And in the case of the last book I did, which is on the UK, I met a lot of people from working class backgrounds who did not feel that they benefit. It's not that they didn't benefit from racism, but they didn't feel they were treated that much better than a lot of the black British people because of the class system. So I think there are some white people who feel that they are also victims, although obviously not in the same way, of the structure. And for those, and also I met white people who had developed close friendships as children with blacks. And so they, at a young age, developed a bond or a friendship, and that made them more sensitive. And they did not necessarily, enjoy being in a dominant position over black people because they had developed these friendships at a young age and they actually wanted to have more egalitarian relationships. They weren't the majority. But I think there are some people, particularly white people who I met, who as children developed close friendships, wanted as adults to have friendships. And so they had been challenged by their black friends. You know, they had been challenged to make changes in how they relate it to the black community.
I believe Non-Mighty Wick, did you have a question?
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thanks for being on the program. Dr. Twine, is it, or Ms. Twine?
Yes, thank you.
Oh, no problem. I wanted to see, get the impression that your book, you know, this is pretty much the only, in this interview is what I've heard from you and then parts of your book. I mean, it seems that white people, you know, who read it and experience your work would be, you know, that they're gonna be better racist as a result of it.
Better racist?
Yeah, they're going to be more improved in their ability to practice racism, and that the non-white people who come across it would be more confused into thinking that, you know, that white people should be pursued in an attempt to, you know, educate them into being less racist. Do you honestly think that that would be a constructive use of a black person's time and energy? I mean, particularly a more informed, less confused black person, or are you more so just trying to, you know, like carve out a niche, you know, for your book or for your work?
Well, first of all, have you read the book? Have you read my book?
Not entirely.
Okay. So, you know, I think I would love to talk to you at more length when you've actually read the whole book. I would be very disappointed if what you said was true, if my book merely helped white people become better racist. I think that there are other, I think that a lot of people have become better racist or better at hiding it because of political, the backlash in our country, in the United States anyway, that began really, I would say, with the election of Ronald Reagan. I honestly am not interested in carving out a niche for myself. I would be very disappointed if this book did not have a use value for anti-racist activists, and I really hope that you're wrong. And I hope that maybe when you have a chance to really read the book closely, that maybe you'll walk away with a different opinion. The book hasn't been out that long, so it's really difficult for me to evaluate the impact because it's only been out for a couple of months. And I sincerely hope that what you're predicting isn't the fate of the book. I would be very disappointed in that.
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too. I hope I am 100% incorrect. But do you think that...
and you may not, you know...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, you know what I was going to say? I don't even know if it's a matter of you being incorrect. It's possible that the book could have an impact different people differently, and that maybe you're right. Maybe some people could read it and come away with new skills, but I would really be disappointed and saddened by that if that were the only impact.
Do you think that, black people could read your work and then feel like it would be a constructive use of their time to pursue white people in America,
right,
to get them to be less racist? Do you think that's something that black people should
do? You know, it's hard. Okay, it's very difficult to answer that question, and the reason it is I don't, I mean, I cannot say to you that, first of all, there are black people who are in different positions, right? Do I think that a black person who, let's say, working class background, trying to raise their family, they have a lot of stuff to do? Do I think the best use of their time is necessarily reading my book? I don't know that I could say that. But I think that there are people who are in positions to educate people or have influence, and I would hope they would find something useful in the book. But I cannot make an argument that all black people should, you know, sit down and read this book, because I really did write it. I think the book is probably more useful for either black people who don't think racism is a problem, and the black community is more ideologically diverse than it used to be, but I wouldn't feel comfortable predicting how useful this is for any individual black person, because I think people bring their own histories and experiences to what they read. And this book is also about the UK, England. It's not based on the U.S. experience. So there may be people in the U.S. who feel like it's not worth their time. I think it is. I think there are some parallels with how racism operates on both sides of the Atlantic, but I really have to let the reader judge that. So perhaps when the book's been out a year from now, Gus will invite me back on the show, and when people have had time to really read it, you guys can go at me again and let me know, you know, what you think when you've had a chance to really digest it.
Sure. I would just say for the listeners, for my two cents, I concluded it's definitely not a constructive use of time trying to get white people or convince them to not practice racism. I concluded they intend to do that forever. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Yep. Unfortunately, ditto on that conclusion. It's quite sad. But I think the problem can be solved. We got to be truthful about it. We would love to have you back on the program anytime. I have, an extraordinary amount of respect for people who can just be truthful. If white people could do that, I would have a better outlook. If white people could just do that, just tell the truth, man, I would have a much more optimism. But I haven't seen even that they're willing to do that on a consistent basis. I thoroughly enjoyed having you on the program. The book, again, that we discussed today, A White Side of Black Britain, Interracial Intimacy and Racial Literacy. Very interesting. The white people have some interesting things to share in this book. Before you roll, I am curious. I think it's relevant. Have you ever been married to a white person?
Have I ever been? Yes, I was 10 years ago.
Okay. Just curious. Do you think that could have an impact on your views and your hopefulness about white people?
Actually, not in terms of hope, no. No, I don't, honestly, I've had a wide range of experiences, and I don't really think that may be more hopeful, no.
Okay.
And like I said, this book is not about the U.S. And it's not really about my personal life. But, I don't want to give the impression that I'm naive or that I'm so hopeful I don't see reality. I think that I was really just interested in seeing and understanding, are there white people, in this case we're talking the UK, who have been able to recognize and name racism when they see it, and have they been able to equip their children? Right, because these aren't people who've adopted children. These are people who, gave birth to these children. Are they in a position to equip their children to deal with the racism that they may encounter? That was the motivation. So, yeah. Well, it was really a privilege to be on your show. Thank you so much. And I really learned a lot from this conversation.
I did as well. Thank you for sharing a bit of your Saturday evening. And anytime, if you write anything new, essays, books, we would love to have you back on the program.
Okay, thank you so much.
Have a great evening.
It's really been a pleasure. Okay, you too.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Peace. Context of white supremacy. Again, our guest joining us live from California. Professor France Windance Twine. Hope the listener who suggested her, it was over a year ago, about a year and a half ago. I hope she is still listening, if it's a constructive use of her time, and I hope she was able to hear the program. The caller in California, she was only supposed to be here for 90 minutes. I missed your question, but I will go to you as soon as I go to the phone lines to get your questions and or comments. You'll be the first person I go to. My apologies. We'll take a quick commercial, come back, see if Justice has any thoughts. We'll do news, and we'll hit the phone lines. Context of white supremacy, we'll be right back.
RacismDaily.com, your number one source for global news reports on race, racism, and overt actions of white supremacy. From Asia to the Americas to Europe to Australia to Africa, racism is not a thing of the past. It is our current reality. Be informed. Be globally informed. You should be the first to know. RacismDaily.com. RacismDaily.com. RacismDaily.com.
Issues of race. Are you unable to speak, think, and act? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny? Smiling when you are not happy? Agreeing when you really disagree? GlobalRacism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by counterracism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's counter-racism.com.
Do you need a one-stop shop for all of your multimedia needs? Triumphant Multimedia is a skilled team of professionals with a passion for great marketing and chic design. Our specialties include consulting, brand development, copywriting, and creative graphic design. That's second to none. We also offer photography, photo retouching, videography, and video editing. At Triumphant Multimedia, our goal is to provide highly effective creative solutions built to suit any individual need or budget. Give us a call at 678-732-8067 or check us out online at trimultimedia.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. This is Justice with the Cause Regular Program. If you want to learn about, understand, and counter racism, white supremacy, be sure not to miss a Cows episode. We keep them jammed-packed with constructive information to sharpen your use of words to help eliminate the system of racism, white supremacy, ASAP. Also, for more information on racism, white supremacy, and to invest in my counter-racist efforts, please visit my blog, justdojusticetoday.blogspot.com.
You're just saying just buckets and buckets of words.
Context of white supremacy. Very interesting program. Very interesting program. I would love to have her back on the broadcast anytime. Be great to have her on. And the reason I have respect for people who can be truthful. I think she was pretty honest. I think to say, you know, hey, I can't say that my work is constructive for black people. It might not be. And most important, you know, to say, hey, I did not set out to write a book that was accurate about the system of white supremacy. She said that. If people are willing to be truthful, that's all we need. Like, you know, if you can say that, hey, I wrote this book and this is not an accurate representation of white supremacy, no problem. If we could do that, if everybody could do that, man, we could cut through, man, we could get this thing done and, you know, start looking at your watch. If we start having people just, if we could just be a little more truthful about, you know, the workings of racism, white supremacy, how we experience it, really our victimization, you know, we could knock this thing out in no time flat. Justice, did you have any thoughts about the program, anything you heard from our guest, Professor Twine? Okay, no. Your line should be open. Are you there?
Okay, can I be here now?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I don't have any thoughts about the program. No.
Oh, okay. And did you have anything you wanted to share?
I do have a news report, but I don't have do not have a computer at this time. Or actually, if you could read it, you do have your computer right there, correct?
I reckon.
Okay, my report is on racismdaily.com. If you could go there, it's the recent one that you see there.
Is it the one about the teens being arrested for racial graffiti? That's the title of it. Is that it?
It's the graffiti one.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, it's that one.
Okay. This is June 18th, 2011. This was just this morning. The title of the report is Three Teens Arrested for Racial Graffiti at Montgomery County High School. Police have arrested enforcement officers have arrested three teenagers in connection with white supremacist graffiti spray painted on the walls of Poolsville High School earlier this week. On June 13th, a school employee showed up at work to discover swastikas, the letters KKK, and numerous racial slurs, including porch monkeys, beware Planet of the Apes, written with spray paint around the school grounds. In addition to the vandalism, officials discovered that a John Deere Gator tractor belonging to the school had been stolen. The three arrested have been charged with burglary and destruction of property. The suspects are a 14-year-old from Germantown, a 16-year-old from Dickerson, and a 16-year-old from Poolsville, all white males. Police released the teens to their parents. Again, the title of this report, Three Teens Arrested for Racial Graffiti at Montgomery County High School. And they have a photograph. If you go to racismdaily.com, you can see some of the photographs of the graffiti. You can see where they have porch monkeys, beware. You can see that where they painted it on the side of the school. They blurred out monkeys for some reason. I'm really not a fan of that. If they said porch monkey, let's put that up there so we're all clear about, you know, what was said. Any thoughts on that one, Justice?
Do you think I don't want to be incorrect about my thoughts, but do you think you can read the first part of that article, like the first paragraph or something?
First paragraph, police have arrested three teenagers in connection with racial graffiti spray painted on the walls of Poolsville High School earlier this week. That's the first sentence, or excuse me, that's actually the first sentence and the first paragraph.
The name calling part, I think it's called like something monkeys. I forgot
what. Monkeys.
That is very interesting. Like you said, a Planet of the Apes, because, you know, that is, slur is like Planet of the Apes.
It's pretty common once you start paying attention to it. Unfortunate, you know, it's nothing to be pleased about, but I mean, I think it's correct to be truthful that it's just further evidence, you know, of white people's commitment to practicing white supremacy, and that's a big part of it, the Samboification. Non-white people are animals. They're not humans, and therefore, you know, they're worthy of being mistreated. That's, you know, a big part of their package. Any other thoughts on this report?
No.
Go ahead.
But I will tell you that I am soaking wet.
Has been raining. I've been listening.
Yes.
It's been dumping quite a bit. Don't get your socks wet. I hate having soggy socks. That is the worst. If you can at least keep your feet and socks dry on the plantation. It's a little more bearable. I'm going to read actually a second news report, and then I'll check the phone lines. I'll get the gentleman, as I said, that called in from California. I'll get you, and then if other people, if they want to share their thoughts, what have you, I'll get their lines as well. This other report is interesting because I heard that term fair pop up quite a bit today. Fairy tales, I think it was said at least three times. This article is also on racismdaily.com. Bank settles with Justice Department over allegations of discrimination. In a settlement with the Department of Justice, Midwest Bank Center has agreed to resolve allegations that it had practiced white supremacy against black people, black residential mortgage customers in St. Louis, Missouri from 2006 to 2008. This type of white supremacy is part of the web of intolerable practices that stripped vast amounts of wealth from non-white people in the last decade, said Thomas Perez, Assistant Attorney General for the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division. The DOJ claimed the bank violated the Fair Housing Act and the Equal Credit Opportunity Act. The bank also scored a low satisfactory, in quotes, rating in two out of three areas of its fair lending review. Midwest Bank Center denied the allegations, but has agreed to open a full-service bank and invest $1.45 million in predominantly black areas of St. Louis. The investment includes $900,000 in financing to increase credit in black neighborhoods, $300,000 for credit repair and credit education programs, and $250,000 for outreach to new customers. We are pleased to be moving forward, Bank Chairman Ronald T. Barnes said in a press release. Midwest Bank Center will continue to advance constructive banking, lending, and educational programs that will make a meaningful difference in our community. The St. Louis region has been good to Midwest Bank Center for 105 years, and we look forward to continuing our efforts to help address the economic challenges so many in our community are facing today. Title of that report, Bank Settles with Justice Department over allegations of discrimination, a.k.a. racism, white supremacy. This is also from today, June 18th, racismdaily.com, to be expected, and in fact, definitely to be expected from the, the Fair Housing Act with their Fair Lending Review Board. You should definitely expect, you know, racism, white supremacy. Yeah, I'll leave it at that. We will be back tomorrow. Neely Fuller Jr. Will be on the program, his 13th visit. I'm going to make an effort to allow listeners to ask questions for the full program so we can take questions immediately. Same thing we did with Mr. Williams last time. So if you have questions you'd like to ask Mr. Fuller, would like clarification on something that's in the word guide or the code book or something you've heard him say on a program, we will have time tomorrow. The program is at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Pacific. Neely Fuller Jr., 13th visit, we'll be doing calls immediately. So if you would like to ask something tomorrow, we should be able to get to a lot of people. We'll be going to the phone lines immediately. So if you call in, just put a hand up, and we will get you on so you can speak with Mr. Fuller. Always a pleasure to speak. I will tell you, I think the caller message, Anton, he said his name, Anton, he was saying, you know, definitely give Mr. Fuller a call. He is just always helpful. I think it's very constructive to speak with him. He provides a lot of clarity. He just has so much information. He's experienced. experienced so much racism, white supremacy. He just has a lot of real-life documentation of the conduct of white people. But I spoke with him this past week. Man, the film Frankie and Alice, I watched it. It's one of the worst films I've ever seen, and when I say worst, I mean just a really degrading depiction of black people. Not as bad as Precious, but worse than Monster's Ball, if I'm trying to give you an idea. I mean, it's close to Precious. It's close. Really difficult to watch. White people making entertainment out of the fact that they have driven us to be insane and mentally ill as a result of white supremacy. But I was watching this film, and then I spoke with Mr. Fuller, and I asked him, I said, or I was saying, things would be so much better if we could just be truthful, if we could just be honest, if we talked about how white people have victimized us and mistreated us, if we could just be truthful about that and tell that to other victims, we would be so much better off. And he said, yeah, but, I've never really heard Mr. Fuller sound this way in talking about racism. And he said, you know, he would have to compare it to war. He served in the conflict in Korea, was known as the Korean War. I think he participated in another conflict as well, what they call a veteran. And he said, the only thing I can compare it to is war. And when you are in combat and it's intense pressure, all that trauma, you just want to get out. It's just not something that you can talk about. And for a lot of black people who experienced a less refined, more overt and more violent system of white supremacy, he said, it's just like you just don't want to talk about it. And he said, you know, there are things that I can't talk about. There are things that I have to put out of my mind, which is mental illness. Just want to be very clear about that, because he said, hey, I am suffering from mental illness. That is mental illness, when you have to block things out and not think about them because you know that trauma will have that much of an adverse impact on your well-being. That is mental illness. And he said, I have to do that. There are things that I can't think about, that I don't want to talk about, that I've experienced because of white supremacy. And he said, that's a lot of black people, that so much of the victimization is so intense that it's just relief. It's just relief that it's over, and I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to think about it. And, you know, just be thankful that it's a little bit better now. It was an experience to hear that from Mr. Fuller, just to be reminded of the damage of racism, white supremacy. It was significant. With that, he'll be on the program tomorrow, and I will hit the phone lines. The gentleman that called in from, well, I don't know if it's a gentleman, my apologies. The person who called in from California had a hand up to ask a question. I'm going to your line, so if you want to share the question that you did not get to ask or any thoughts about the program, feel free, and then I can get to other people if you all have questions or comments you'd like to share. Caller in California, your line is open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus and Justice, Nah Mighty Wick. Nah Mighty Wick kind of was in the ballpark of my question, so that was cool. I was going to ask Dr. Twine that if she was willing to, change directions. Because when I hear the term anti-racist, what I think of is the graviton or the Higgs boson. Racists are spending billions of dollars looking for these things, and chances are they don't exist. But that doesn't stop them from building this giant hadron collider and just spending a lot of resources trying to find these things. And it's really a waste of money, and waste of time. It's the same with the anti-racist. It's like we're looking for this entity that might exist. You know, it's so rare. We need, you know, to build a, 100-mile machine to detect it, you know, in underground facilities to try to get a glimpse of it. And it's all theory. And there's no evidence of this thing. But so you spend all this time and money on looking for something that it has no proof that it exists. And you were saying something like it is an I wish. And I have that, you know, written down. It's like it is what it is, not what I want it to be. So I was just gonna ask her if she would be willing to, you know, change directions, because I feel like looking for an anti-racist is futile.
To be expected from victims, and white people know that. White people know. White people have been on this program and shared that. They know a part of our victimization is to search for a white person or white people who are not racist. They know that's a part of our conditioning. So, unfortunate, it's to be expected.
I sent you a news article. I'm not sure if you got it or not. I don't trust my email. I don't know if you heard that. I said I don't trust my email. So sometimes people.
Oh, I heard.
Oh. Yeah, sometimes.
Good people, reason.
Yeah, it's crazy. Sometimes people get things, sometimes they don't. But yeah, it was a very interesting news article. And yeah, if you get it, just, you know, send me a wire. Let me know if you got it or not.
I'm looking at it now. I'm looking at it now.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yes. If you read it and want to share it, I think it's pretty interesting. Like I said, when Justice asked the question, you know, who are these, you know, what are these white people's names that these powerful white people, that these powerful races, that article, you know, it names names, and it's a pretty amazing article, I thought. So if you read it and find it worth, and if anybody, you know, would like to read it, maybe we can get it to them, you know, just to, so we can identify who these, some of these people are and what they're doing. Because what I've seen is that the more powerful races, they're more destructive. If you want to have a definition for what is, when we say the most powerful or the more powerful races, the definition we can have for that is, and proof of that is to say that they're more powerful, is they're more destructive. They're, you know what I'm saying, they're way more destructive. So I think that that's an accurate definition. So, yeah. That's all I have.
I just put it on my Facebook page, so folks can check it out. It's titled "The Really Creepy People Behind the Libertarian Inspired Billionaire Sea Castles." I just put it on my Facebook page. My Facebook is facebook.com/ The Problem Is White People. It's the most recent. It should be the one at the top of the page. You can go there, click it, read it. Looks very interesting. It does not. What I'm looking at here does not look like white people who, you know, are working on anti-racism. These people, if they had this same sort of commitment to anti-racism, this problem would have been solved, you know, long time ago. There would be no need for the cows at all. I don't know if people don't know the code or people have just been spectating the past few days, but We had more participation when I just went through and opened up all the lines. People talked. Since I've been requesting that people press star 8, there are fewer, there's less participation. I don't know if that is people don't know the queue or laziness or I'm not sure what that is, but yeah, we had more participation when I opened up. I mean, eventually, you know, it is going to have to be. I mean, we're pretty much there now. People are going to have to go back to pressing the queue because they're just, it's a lot of people calling in the way it used to be at Blog Talk Radio, and there's just too many people to go through, you know, all those lines. So it's great to have the participation. Just press star 8. Yeah, I'm just noting an observation. So
yeah, it's,
the other folks,
I think it's the, yeah, I think it's the L word, because even myself, I'm like, you know, that's just one more thing I got to do. You know, I got to, you can't just open the line up. I got to press buttons now.
I totally understand. You know, I'm a victim too, and that's part of our victimization, I think. But I mean, if we can't press star 8 to combat racism, white supremacy, woo, we are
right.
We are going. Oh, okay, there we go. I'm not baiting people. I'm just noting an observation. If you all don't have anything to say, that is cool. And the gang, I can put my feet up, download the program, and prep for, you know, other things. I'm just noting an observation that I think could be some laziness. Sir Anton, your line is open. Gentleman who called in with the handle Sir Anton, your line is open. Not sure. Maybe
can I be heard now?
Oh, okay. Yes.
Okay. I missed a majority of the program, so I was just listening. I just felt lazy because I didn't press start. So. Thought I would combat racism, white supremacy by pressing star 8. So I'm just listening for right now.
Understood, sir. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I thought it was a very constructive program, and because she revealed truth, I have a lot of respect for that. Just to be honest, and to even be honest to say, you know, I can't really say that I set out to write an accurate book about white supremacy. I thought that was, you know, and the quotes. And the quotes, it just, white identification, I had that so many times, white identification. Like I had terms written down at the top of my page when I started reading her book. The three terms that I had, conflation, that's a term we've shared repeatedly on the program, conflation, that's bringing in sexism, classism, what they call homophobia, heterosexism, bring everything. Let's throw everything in along with racism, white supremacy, conflation. You can get that. The blog, Bandung 2. I will hang on once. I'll get there. The blog for the Bandung website. It's on my. Oh, I got it right here. Bandung2.blog.co.uk. Great information on racism, white supremacy, and the term. He has a great codified definition for conflation. The address again, bandung2.blog.co.uk. The term conflation. So that was one term I had at the top of my page. Second term I had was white identification. And the last term I had the acronym SAD, making space for white people who are not racist. Self-evident, I think. Being abstract about the system of racism, white supremacy, not focusing it on white people, but talking about structural racism, institutional racism, not white people. The 1D for defending white people, and the other D, divided loyalties, being confused about what side you are on in the war of white supremacy, the acronym SAD, which is on my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Yeah, those are the three terms I had at the top of my page, and I think, I think anyone, if you heard the program and you know what those terms mean, I think self-evident. Pam is on the line. She is not being lazy. She pressed star 8. Pam, your line is open.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
Yeah. I just happened to call, you know, I just happened to catch the show. I missed most of it. So I'm listening, and I just wanted to let you know I wasn't being lazy. I just didn't get a chance to get to listen to the show.
Always good to hear from Pam. TrojanHorse1.com. TrojanHorse1.com. Folks, be curious when folks get to hear the archives. I'll be curious, particularly anybody that is familiar with her work. I know Mr. Edward Williams, he was familiar with her work, Edward Williams, counter-racism.com, and some of the other listeners, they knew a little bit about her material.
Excuse me, Gus. I did have a question. Was this a white person that was your guest, or a black person, or a non-white person?
A black female.
Black female.
Black female. She did say that she had been married to a white man. Oh, and she said she also had a white step parent for a time as well.
Was it the step parent male or female?
Male.
Okay. I'm going to download the show is as soon as you upload it.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say I am a bit familiar with your guest. I've seen her. I'm not sure where, but she was speaking and it was recorded, and I seen her talking. And just the thoughts that I had was that some of the accounts that she gave in this book in particular, just like with the daughter saying that, hope he didn't lie. And using the right words, knowing the right words to use, just not to be suspicious. I mean, even though it's right there, to err on the side of white people, I don't think that's you know, that just doesn't seem like, why would you want to give them the benefit of the doubt? Why would you want to err on the side of saying, you know, this person could be, you know, practicing racism, or this person might be just using the right words? And then you look at some other behaviors and say, oh, no, you know, probably not. No, what I'm going to say is that this person is anti-racist, you know, that they're really sincere and, you know, why would you, that seems very dangerous to me. Like, I'm thinking of survival. It would just seem like it would be in your best interest to say, yeah, this person could be more refined, just refined, and you look at their actions, like they're married to a black female, and there's a white male, or they're married to a black male, and they're a white female. They're anti-racist. So why aren't they saying, like, look, you know, to my child, like, look, what I've done, you know, what I've done, the reality of what I've done here is, you know, it's grave. I'm just letting you know, like, this, you know, we're here now. This is the situation. I'm your father, or I'm your mother. But what I've done is practice, what I've done, it was extremely racist and extremely harmful for you, extremely confusing for you. Like, I need to get you a surrogate mother or a surrogate father, somebody black, to you know, that you can be around and, you know, let you know, what's up, you know. And at all times, I'm going to tell you that I might be telling you something for my own enjoyment, to see you fail, to see you look stupid, to see you confused. You know what I'm saying? That's you know, somebody like that, I might start looking at them a little bit different. Like, wow, this person is like straight up telling their own children that, look, I'm the most dangerous person that in your life. But yeah, I don't see that. I don't understand why that's like, it's in her own, it's right there in her book. But she decided, I mean, I'm not beating up on her or anything like that. I'm just saying, like, for people, you can't, why go the other direction? Have you ever heard of a white person that has a black child be telling their children, like, man, I'm, you know, you can't trust me. You cannot trust me. And what do you think that would do to that child? You think that would be more damaging to the child, or vice versa, just not telling them anything? I'm asking you, Gus.
I mean, that's. I'll be quiet. Other people, you know, press star 8 if you have questions or comments or what have you. My thought is just maximum racist aggression. Now, just imagine that, a child growing up in an environment where their mother is the person they should trust the least. Now, just imagine that, and I'll mute my line.
I would also add that a lot of white women who have non-white children, they don't care for non-white females. So what about the white female who has a non-white daughter, but she doesn't like non-white females? And I've also seen that with white males who have had sons, but they don't like black men. They've had sons with black women, but they don't have a single black male friend, and they're not comfortable. I have it in my family. They're not comfortable around black men at all, but they have sons that are classified as black.
Pam, I don't know if you heard, but Gus had asked the guest that he basically said that, you know, I would ask him, you know, are you a racist? And that's basically, that's all I need to know. And he asked her if she thought that having control of a black person is part of their racism. She kind of reacted. I don't know what the she said something, but I don't think she was. It didn't really go any further than that. But I don't think she really kind of really. I don't know what she was thinking when Gus asked her that, but she did ask her that. Like, man, I got this black child, and I got total power over it. That's part of my racism right there. That's a part of my entertainment. That's a part of my. Man, that's what it means to be white. That's, you know, I got to be a slave here. I got control over this black person.
I think that's why they adopt black children. I think it's partly a fad, partly a pet, but also I believe that it's the same as buying children back in slave days. You're buying a thing. You're buying and selling human beings. I just think it's more of this, we are the lords and masters of the planet, and everything on the planet belongs to us. And non-white people are just our property, including non-white people's babies. Because if they really cared about non-white babies, African babies, and black babies, they'd be fighting the system that makes them orphans. And they'd be fighting the system that keeps non-white and black parents from being parents. They don't touch that. They just want to be Lord and masters and white saviors and pound their chest and say, I'm saving the poor, uncivilized, non-whites, you know. So it's all part of this God complex, in my opinion.
I mean, even the cows that he did when he was at the university, when they were doing it at in a Dirty Dog or whatever, radio or whatever.
Rainy Dog.
Okay. Yeah. That interview with that white female, the racist, you know, she was basically saying, like, you know, that was just, some, even though some parts were, but she, you know, that was the most honest, that was one of the most honest interviews I've heard from a white person. Like, where are these white people that are so-called anti-racist saying, listen, don't trust me, like don't trust me, don't trust white people. You cannot trust us. If you think you have a white friend, you're only deluding yourself. That's a wish. That is not reality. That is not what is. What is white people are racist. I mean, giving them that heart, giving them that message, like, boom, like, this is what it is. Like, where are these so-called anti-racists that are popping up everywhere? That don't seem to be their message. I might be incorrect in all that, but it just don't seem like that's their heart. Shouldn't that be, I mean, I don't know, do you guys think that should be the main message? You cannot trust white people. They're not going to stop. Not even me. I'm just telling you, you know, for whatever reason I have, you know, that I just decided to tell y'all. But that don't mean anything. I'm just telling you. You know what I'm saying? So, like, I don't know.
Yeah. I have no faith.
I agree with that.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Thanks to cows, I have absolutely, totally no faith whatsoever or use for white anti-racist activists. I think they've been thoroughly exposed on cows, and I think the biggest and the best and the most refined have been exposed on cows. And so for me, the case has been proven. I'm done.
I think the white people in the book, A White Side of Black Britain, I think they said it better than, again, Mr. Fuller says, you know, white people can show you better than I can tell you. I think the white people, their commentary and their behavior, like I said, even the daughter of one of these white women said, man, you better watch her. She is good at using words to talk about. I mean, her daughter saying that, I mean, that... one thing I did want to make sure I got in very clearly, which I think just further evidences the lack of constructive value in focusing on so-called anti-racist white people. Not only in this book does she acknowledge that most of the white people who are married to non-white people, these people do not, you know, do any so-called anti-racist work. They don't do anything to show that they are against racism, most of them, not anything. But the real kicker, there are not that many of these marriages anyway. The group of that she's focusing on, white people married to black people in Britain, the population, according to numbers in her book from the 2001 census, the population in the area of the world known as the United Kingdom is over 91% white. These are the statistics she quotes in her book from the 2000 census. In her book, population is over 91% white. Most of these white people are not going to be in sexual relationships with non-white people. It's not even that many of them there. It can't be that many of these relationships. This is in her book. So, I mean, for me, it's like we're talking about a very small number of these tragic arrangements in the first place. And then even among that small number, most of them are not doing anything to even remotely look like they're working against racism. By her own numbers, I mean, we're looking at like a fingernail of a fingernail And even then, it's like, well, you know, these folks could be fooling us too. I mean, that is, I mean, really, that's what we're talking about. I just wanted to make sure that that was on the records. If you get her book, she has population statistics from the census. 91% of the British pop, you, excuse me, 91% of the UK population, white. So there are not that many of these relationships, period. Just wanted that on the record.
I saw some statistics for the U.S. and as far as interracial marriage, and less than, I think it was at the time, less than 9%, or maybe close to 9% of white people marry outside their race. That means the other 91% don't even marry black people, white, Asian people, Hispanics, or nothing. And black people were the had the fewest out of all non-white people, the fewest numbers of marriages between whites and non-whites were black people. So white people marry black people less than they marry any other single non-white group.
Yeah, that was something that was striking for me. I mean, if you talk about, you know, anti-racist, and then one of the qualities is, you know, they're married to a non-white person. Like, whoa, you know, that's a terrible thing. I mean, that basically X's it out right there. Like, okay, just that quality alone makes them not what you're saying that they are. I wonder, is that one of the qualities that they try to give to so-called anti-racists, is that they, you know, they have relationships with non-white people, and you know, they adopt non-white people. That's the quality I think that they're trying to give to anti-racists, and that's I wonder if people are really falling for that, because that should be an indicator right there that it's not what they say that it is. It should be the total opposite. Like, I would never do that to you. You know, that maximum aggression. It should be the absolute. It should be the total opposite. Crazy.
Sometimes I think they're on the payroll. You know, especially these celebrities. I sometimes wonder. You know, this thing is so well orchestrated. It's like watching a game that's been played, that's been planned from the beginning, and they have all these players, and it's different. You know, we're like in the Matrix, and they're just making up these artificial realities. And sometimes I wonder if these white people are being paid and being encouraged to adopt black children. Are they being encouraged to be with non-whites? You know, it's just so, the effect is so devastating that it's almost like it has to be planned. Like they allow a certain percentage of them, or they, you know, it's like they came out of a test tube and they created robots and they sent them out into the non-white world, and they're just doing the work of white supremacy. But they can leave enough people around to do the other work, but they set aside a certain percentage of white people to do this other thing. It just seems so planned to me. It just makes me wonder how random it is.
Something. I agree. You know, I think if it wasn't highly allowed, you know, in the system of white supremacy, we wouldn't see so much support of it. You know, you have more people who will say, yeah, you know, I'm in support of anti-racism, or, you know, helping anti-racists out, and won't even think about the complete elimination of a system of white supremacy, you know. I almost wouldn't even connect with both of those at the same time, but they'll connect with the anti-racist idea because prevalent is just encouraged.
I remember when Tim Weiss,
yeah,
was on the, I don't know which show it was, but he says, I guess you think I'm some kind of paid agent or something. I don't know if you remember the comment that Gus Tim Weiss made.
I remember him saying that.
And so right then and there, it reminded me of when people are lying, they will actually throw out what they're really doing as though to throw you off the scent. I'll say, this is so incredible. If me saying it like this, they couldn't. I suspect something is going on. I do know a friend of mine who had a brother that worked, and I wanted to meet this brother so bad, but I never got a chance to meet him. He had a brother that worked in Washington circles, and he knew a lot of people in the inner circle. but he traveled a lot. So this friend of mine promised to let me meet his brother, but I suspect his brother didn't want to meet me. I don't know. I never met him. But to make a long story short, he used to tell my friend things. And the one thing I do remember was, and I checked it out for myself, a lot of these white homeless people, particularly like I'm in Chicago, and you'll see them occasionally downtown and this and that, and he said that he believes that sometimes they pay them to make it look like, well, white people are suffering too. So that when black people see these homeless white people out there, and I'm not saying all white people, I'm just saying like downtown area in Chicago or maybe real certain areas. And one time after he told me that, I was getting off the train and I was going to stop by this little restaurant thing and get whatever, you know, before I went to work. And this white guy was sitting, now this is downtown Chicago in the financial district. He was sitting down by the stairs on the sidewalk. He, you know, like he was homeless, but when I looked at him, his hair looked like it had been freshly cut. His clothes were clean. He looked like what you would call a white male, educated white male to me. He didn't look like a bum. He didn't look like he had been homeless. And he was sitting there like he was a homeless person. And then down the street, they had a couple of people laying on the sidewalk. Now, this was before it really got bad. This was maybe about five years ago. And I thought crossed my mind. I said, man, I wonder if he's right. Are they paying white people to be out here playing all these different roles to make this matrix complete? So I don't know. You know, I really don't know. I could be incorrect. But this guy did not look homeless. He just didn't.
Absolutely. We do not understand white people. It's they're down there, guaranteed. And I'm just glad that you guys brought that up because black people ain't thinking on that level. But white people, that's 500 years ago tactic. You feel me?
Yeah.
They This is old tactics. Yeah, you think they're not down there? They're of course, absolutely they're down there. But, you know, just the fact that you guys are talking about it, I appreciate because black people are not thinking on that level.
I wasn't either. I never thought of it until he told me. And I think that he had a lot of insight because of his brother. And his brother knew a lot of stuff, some of which I would never say on air. And I'm not trying to be cute. I just wouldn't repeat it, first of all, because I can't verify it. But secondly, because, you know, so, and I really wanted to meet this brother so bad, but I never got a chance to do it because I had a million questions I wanted to ask him. But a lot of the stuff we're seeing is orchestrated. I believe Angelina Jolie, for example. I mean, all of these white, I don't know what's going on, really. But I just suspect that as my friend says, it's a grand game. The problem is most of the non-whites that are in the game don't know they're on the board. And have no idea what's going on, and I'm one of them. I really was surprised at the idea that they would pay white people. I had never thought of that, to appear to be homeless. So while black people are suffering, it makes it look like, well, you know, it can't be, you know, look at white people suffering too. So I never would have thought of that.
White sacrifice. Mighty Wick, I thought you, it sounded like you had a second point you were trying to make. If you're, line is open. You should be good to go.
Yeah. Well, 909 made a half of it. I was just going to say that, you know, I think why it seems a lot of times why Sam was saying, you know, it seems planned. It seems like, you know, they're allowing us all these pieces to be in place. And I think that we were born in the middle of it, you know, 500 years ago when they established, or whatever they did, you know, established the rules, you know, regarding the implementation and operation and accountability of it, you know, we weren't there. You know, we was born and it was already off and running. So we're real, you know, because it's already happening when you develop in thoughts and everything. You know, it's a core part of everything that ends up making a person if they're born, you know, not today.
One thing I was going to toss in as well with regards to the whole, you know, sexual intercourse, I think I've been saying it repeatedly. Non-white people, black people, we do not understand at all about being able to have sex, maybe even have a child with a person that you have every intention of destroying. We do not understand anything about that. White people use this tactic regularly. Regularly. Documented evidence. And that should be kept in mind. When you have population statistics, now those numbers could be false, but if those numbers are accurate, if the population in the UK is 91% white and 9% non-white, all they would have to do is restrict access. Non-white people, okay, can't come in, don't want any more of you immigrant, that's what they call them, immigrants, don't want any more non-white people in this area, and then have sexual intercourse with that little 9% population, three generations, you know, y'all are out of here. Real, and they've done that before, documented evidence. That's, I mean, you talk about orchestrated. White people will have a 500-year orchestrated plan about how we're going to practice white supremacy. I mean, that's a whole nother level of thinking about I'm at war with these people, and I have a 500-year battle plan for being at war with these people. And we're, you know, meanwhile, we're searching for a white person that's not racist. Just wanted to put that out there.
Excellent, excellent. I mean, they write the script, and they're telling this story. It's this their little storyline, and just like a soap opera, they create this storyline, and then they have they're in need of a character, so they create a position for a character and give you that role. So they've already set it up for you. They gave you they're the damsels in distress. We're the monsters, you know, and you know, the heroes are these sadistic Satanists that go around chopping off arms and heads and doing whatever they want, you know. So yeah, it's I find it extremely interesting that this, you know, it's cliche to say Matrix, but since Stewart, Miss Stewart, so I'll say Matrix, whatever, but it's their fantasy that we play out. We play the role of the monster, and, you know, it's incredible that they've created an environment, what Nnamdi Wick was talking about. We're born into an environment where our roles are already, you know, we've been given roles. And that's what you don't. Man, it's like, man, I'm playing a role. I'm playing somebody else's. You know, they cast me as this person. So you're born. They take a little statistic and they start building prisons for you. You know, so when you come of age, you have a place to live. You know, and have some work to do.
That's where it seems like it's headed. Because when you hear these different legislators. Over the last year, one guy said that they should put poor people in work camps and teach them personal hygiene. Another legislator, and if anybody wants to link to these articles, I got them someplace. Another legislator, you may have heard it already. Another legislator said that, what did he say? He said that they should bus poor blacks to farms and let them work on the farms. If you look at a lot of urban areas, black people in my city anyway, I think their intention is to push poor black people, just black people in general, out of the city of Chicago, the areas that we occupy, and push them out where there's farmland. I think that's where the next so-called projects will be built. And guess what? You want to eat? You might have to get out in that farmland and pick crops, because a lot of the Mexican people are going home. And if they're going home, who's going to pick the crops? This is the stuff, I believe, when these legislators and these politicians, whatever, put this out there, they're putting it out there to test the public reaction. I don't believe they're just talking crazy and at the slip of the tongue. I believe they're saying it to gauge the public reaction. They're almost announcing what their intentions may be. So, I mean, they got black people right now on plantations. They got the prisoners in Angola prison in Louisiana in the same fields that their slave ancestors worked. Black male prisoners are out there picking cotton for 90 cents an hour right now as I speak. So when somebody tells me that they're not trying to go back to the old ways, I think the evidence says otherwise.
I'll just throw this out there real quick. I always be a little hesitant to say books and stuff that I read, but I'm just going to say it quickly. Important books that you need to be reading, that you need to read. Family Secrets, The Family of Secrets, and Shock Doctrine.
Shock Doctrine. I heard of that.
Yeah, Shock Doctrine is a Naomi Klein, and this Family of Secrets, I think his name is Russo.
Throw in as well. People are talking about films. That Frankie and Alice, very difficult to watch. It's not very often that, you know, I see a lot of really gruesome images of racism, white supremacy. Frankie and Alice was, it was hard to watch Frankie and Alice. I mean, literally, you have a film where white people are making fun of how they have driven black people crazy because of racism, white supremacy. It's, anyway. The Klansman, also excellent illustration of white supremacy. O.J. Simpson is in The Klansman, which is like a remake of Birth of a Nation. It came out in the 70s. The whole thing is on YouTube. You can watch it in its entirety. I actually enjoyed it quite a bit. I mean, you've got, you know, lots of Klan members running around, but nigger is said a lot. Interestingly, they do not allow the characters to say profanities, you know, the A word, S word, but nigger is, you know, 20,000 times. That's okay. Other thing, O.J. Simpson is pretty much playing Gus T. Renegade, right? He is killing white people, left and right, killing white people, like sniping white people. It is incredible. And he lives. I guess I'm ruining some of it, but he lives. Incredible. Black male stomping through the film, killing racists repeatedly, and he lives. It's kind of incredible. For many – and it's a lot of blatant racism, white people, ritualistic rape of black females, ritualistic killing of black males. Really interesting film, The Klansman. You can watch it on YouTube in its entirety.
Interesting. I don't know, Pam, if you're with Gus's Facebook page. There's an article on there that he just put up. Please, everybody, read it. That has access to it. I don't have a Facebook page, but if you do, man, read that article. The moves that they make when you see some of these people, you can see that they're at war. These people are military, military. Like, they're at war. They're killers. They're soldiers. You know, these people that these politicians and whatnot, and these universities, Stanford, Princeton, whatever, they teach them to be cold, military, and methodical people, and they go out and kill non-white people. This is one. If you read that article, it was talking about this one white person was responsible for like 16 million murders in Congo.
How many?
16 million. I mean, they were. Please read that article. I mean, they on another level. And then he became the second in command of the CIA. That was kind of like his mission. To get the minerals and whatnot from the Congo, shipped off to Belgium. and in doing so, killed off 16 million of black people. He chopped their forearms off as a scare tactic. You got to read it.
Yeah, I've heard about this, something like that. Okay, sir.
Yeah, that's what went on. And so he got his promotion. He went out there and put in work and got his promotion, became the second in command of the CIA. Greenspan, Karl Rove, these people are some of the stuff that they're doing with the CIA and whatnot, like they're on another level. They, like you talked about military, man. But one individual just putting in that much work can kill that many non-white people to get his stripes. It's interesting, man. That's why I'm saying these books will give you some. We're always saying that we don't understand these people, and we really don't. But I think these books might give you guys, and just that article will give you a lot of resources to start understanding what the heck is going on, because they look at us like, and I, what would you guys say? Is it rightfully so? Well, you guys always said it's like we're children, you know what I'm saying, to them. So, okay, we're totally at the mercy of these racists.
What was the name of the article again?
I don't have the.
The Really Creepy People Behind the Libertarian Inspired Billionaire Sea Castles.
Okay, that was that article. Oh, so that information was in there about the. Okay, I have the article, but I didn't finish reading. I didn't know that was information was in there about the 13 million.
Yeah, just go down
okay.
a bit.
Wow.
To the middle of the article, or just read it all.
Okay.
Yes, please read it.
Gus, could you tell me real quick your Facebook page? I thought I had it saved, your Facebook page address.
Facebook.com/theproblemiswhitepeople.
You know, I saw this film a couple of years ago. It was just a short clip, and it shows Belgian soldiers forcing black children. I think there was this one black boy. It looked like he was about 8 years old, to drink worms in it. Never forgot that. And yet we sit there and we go to places like Belgium and the Dutch, and we think that this is a great place. These are great places to go for vacations. But if you know the history of the Belgian people in Africa, yet never want any go anywhere near them. You know, you wouldn't even, as soon as you heard the word Belgium, your spine should crawl, as far as I'm concerned.
If you want to research more on that, there's a great documentary film, and there's a great book. If you want a book, King Leopold's Ghost, I read that. A white person wrote it. Fantastic. He has all the grisly details. There is some racism. He does have some, he is a white person, so there is some racism in it, but tons of information about what happened in the Congo. And Josh Wickett, he wrote a counter-racist film review of that book, which is also excellent. It's on thecode.net. Also, the documentary film White King, Red Rubber, Black Death, fantastic. Very informative. Again, tons of information. And I think they have photographs of what he's talking about, how they would chop off people's hands and what have you. Got to make that rubber quota, big plantation, big crop system in the Congo about rubber. Excellent documentary film. Those would be two recommendations.
And what is it that we don't understand about how they feel about this? And I'm not speaking of anybody in particular, because, I still have my issues, but
that is more than a feeling. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, kind of in regards to that, saying, white people, they pretty much have us functioning children of the planet. And I had a thought to see if anybody. black people are children or boy or, you know, he's not a man. In regards to people like Omar Thornton or out here in Lakewood, Washington, I forgot his name, Maurice. And the other guy, you know, just black people who end up, you know, shooting a bunch of white people. Has anybody ever heard white people talk about them in regards to being like, you know, boys or, you know, not men or anything like that?
I think what I've heard tends to be more of the monster monstrosity category, and those tend to be the people that they castrate, either symbolically or, you know, literally. Those tend to be the ones that they that get rowdy, the Nat Turners and such. Those are the ones that they tend to make sure that, you know, everyone understands we have taken this person's manhood. This is anything but a man, beast, animal, savage, ape, you know, anything but a man. But I can't say I've heard them referenced as children. Although I have to pay attention. I wouldn't be surprised. Anything but a man, I would say, though.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was thinking that, like, if somebody came from another planet and they asked you to describe white people, like, you know, what are white people? You know, how would you describe them? And I think that's a problem. I don't think non-white people would be able to accurately describe races, white supremacists. Man, male and female. They go to university and learn how to plan so-called logically how to kill us and take whatever they want, the land, whatever. You know, they're thinking hard about how to kill and destroy. They're not just randomly, you know, oh, today, you know, blah, 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 what I'm going to do, you know, I'm going to go over to South America or I'm going to go over to Africa. Man, they put their intellect, brain power, the whole faculty, the university, like that whole power structure, that dynamic is focused on one thing, like let's destroy these people. Use them. Whatever the case may be, we don't put them in, you know, just that's a lot of focus and brain power. So they come up with all kind of ideas and 50-year plans, 100-year plans, 500-year plans. That's what their mind power is going towards. That's where their intellect, so-called intellect, whatever you want to call it, that's what it's going towards. That's what these universities are all about. So you're not dealing with fools. And, you know, when I hear black people talk about white people, they be saying, they be clowning. It's like, oh, white people, oh, they corny, oh, they can't dance, they funny looking, blah, blah, blah. Like, man, you don't know what you're dealing with. You don't know what you're dealing with. You're not describing these people accurately. I'm sorry. If you think white people are stupid, come on, man. Like, it's I don't know what to say. It's like a genius reptile. That's only what I mean. That's just what I would say right now. I do have like a description. Like if somebody really wanted to ask me to define what white people are, I have a description. But I just if you can imagine a genius Komodo dragon, total destruction, and he finds. His genius makes it to where he comes up with all type of machinery and ways and of destruction. Not just a club or a rock or something like that. You know, this is what these jets and these automatic weapons and nuclear bombs and whatnot. This is the intellect that goes into destruction.
And that is 3 hours. We'll be back tomorrow. Again, Mr. Fuller, he'll be on the program taking questions for the whole program. So if you have questions for Mr. Fuller, call in. We're going to the phone lines immediately for tomorrow's program. Context of white supremacy, the image. I guess I would have an image if somebody, if, you know, a being came from a different planet and asked me about white people, I would just show them that image of the planet shaking white people off. Like, this is the image I could give you if you asked me about white people. The earth, everything wants to be rid of white people. Everything would be happy if we could just get rid of white people. I could be wrong, but I think that's very accurate. Context of white supremacy, signing out. We'll be back tomorrow. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately.